As we get started, the first thing I want to let you know is I want to let you know how this timeline came about. The first thing I endeavored to do was to sit down and go through my Bible, and I thought, no problem, I'll just put everything in chronological order. So I went through Matthew, and then I went through Luke and added the stuff in, went through Mark, went through John, thought I had it all set. I had some questions, had things I wasn't sure about, had some things I just kind of stuck in because I really couldn't decide. So then I went and I looked up a timeline somebody else had put together. I had a few aha moments. Or I looked at something and went, aha, that makes sense. So I did some rearranging and some adjusting. And then just for good measure, I decided to look at somebody else's timeline, and they had things different. So I did some more aha moments and adjusting. And then in the end, I went back to my Bible and coordinated everything again. And that's why it's late, because every time I looked at the timeline, I would say, okay, I'm going to go through it one more time, just make sure everything's where I want it and in the right spot. I'd go through the timeline and I'd find something that was bothering me just a little. So that's why at the top I chose to put approximate timeline of the last week of Christ. So as we go through this, there are probably people here that are going to have a different opinion than what I've got down on there. And I would love to hear your opinion, because the chances of me having this 100% right are not very good. So I would love to hear your opinion. What I don't want to have happen, and I'm just saying this ahead of time, what I don't want to have happen is to have this class start ending up in a debate as to where things fell. Because in my estimation, the exact timing of a lot of these things is a lot less important than what actually happened. So I want to spend more time talking about that. And if you have a difference of opinion on a timeline issue, again, I would love to hear it. I would love to get this thing perfect. I don't know it can be done perfect, but I'd like to hear your thought. As a result of that, I thought the best way to start out with this is to kind of just review a minute, or maybe learn something for those that haven't really thought about this, an idea of the differences in the Gospels. There are four of them. And they don't all say exactly the same thing, do they? The first three are often referred to as the synoptic Gospels. John is left out of that, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke are often referred to as the synoptic Gospels. They come upon this name by the two Greek bases, syn, which means the same, synonym, right? Syn, which means the same, and then optic, which we're all familiar with, optic nerve, optician, you know, having to do with sight or the way you view something. As a rule, Matthew, Mark, and Luke pretty much have very similar stories that they've included, very similar accounts. That's a change I'm trying to make. I don't know if anybody else is trying to do that. The word story in our English language has a different connotation than account. So I've been trying to change my verbiage to account. So if you hear me say story, feel free to yell account, because I'm trying to change it. Those three have very similar accounts of what happened. They use the same phraseology a lot of times in how they describe what happened or the quotations that they make. But John is different. John is very different. And one of the things, well, also think about this. Luke, we know, is an accomplished historian. How do we know that Luke was an accomplished historian? The book of Acts. The book of Acts. And we can see the book of Acts and its chronology and its accuracy and its description of people and places and things that went on. And Luke, at the beginning of his gospel, how does he How does he describe what he's attempting to do? Do you remember? In Luke chapter 1, he is wanting to make an orderly account in verse 3. That's his goal. So a lot of times, if there were variances, I tended to lean on Luke a little bit more. John, however, is different, isn't it? It's still an accounting of the life and times of Christ, but John is more of a theology. He seems to be wanting to help us understand who Christ was as much as he's trying to help us understand what he did. And so when he relays events in the life of Christ, a lot of times you can see that's his goal. He's trying to use that event to help us see who he was and his purpose here, and not necessarily for informational sake as to what happened. And his chronology a lot of times is different than the other three. Okay, so with that out of the way, we're now going to have a little bit of an introduction to some important people. Whenever we look at a history of something that's occurred, a lot of times it's important to get some context, to get a feeling of what was going on at the time, who the important people were, what they were doing, what they were thinking, where they came from, their background, because that can help us see a little bit of why the things happened the way they did, and sometimes why Christ interacted with them the way he did. So we're going to look just a little bit at some of these people. Tiberius Julius Caesar Augustus. Now, he is mentioned by name, Luke chapter 3, and I won't do this with all of these people, but I want to mention this one because this is important. Luke chapter 3, starting with verse 1. Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judah, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea, and the region of Trachonitis, and Licinius, tetrarch of Abilene, while Annas and Caiaphas were high priests, the word of God came to John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness. Luke, the historian, lays it all out for us, doesn't he? He just sets it up perfectly. There can be no mistake to the people of that time. As Charles was explaining, it's hard for us to take that sometimes and go back and really accurately place it in a specific year. And I agree with Charles. I'm not sure we can really nail it down too well. But as far as the people of this time, they knew exactly when these things happened. 15th year of a certain... If I was to say in the fourth reign of President Clinton, you'd be able to nail that down pretty close. You'd know pretty for sure exactly when that happened. You'd know things that were going on in your life at that time, if you thought about it long enough. And he names several of the important people. But let's talk about Caesar for just a little bit. He was named after his adopted father. He was adopted by Caesar Augustus, which is kind of an interesting story in of its own. The short synopsis version is that his mother divorced her husband and married Caesar Augustus. So because of that, he considered himself the stepson of a god. That's the way he viewed himself. Gives us a little bit of insight into who he was. He was raised in luxury and privilege, and that was not a place he came from originally. He was not born into that, he was adopted into that. And he took really quickly to the intrigue and the political and all of the atmosphere of what was going on in Rome. He knew that to become a Caesar, it would be better if he had military experience, so he joined the military and was commanding armies by the age of 20. He was considered a great general. One of the things he did while he was in the army was he was one of the main generals, if I understand it correctly, that helped repel the barbarians, the Germanic barbarians in his case, from making it to Rome and taking Rome. So he was considered somewhat of a war hero. He had a fondness of two things, abundance and perversion. And his entire life, it seems, revolved around those two things. He wanted a lot of as much as he could get, and his perversions were quite extreme. He was a glutton, he was a constant drunk, he was a sex addict, he was a pedophile, and he was a murderer. I mean, if you can put a negative spin on somebody, he had it. He had it. Because of this, he didn't live in Rome. He lived in a place on Capri, off the coast of Italy, called Villa Jovis. That's the way I'm pronouncing it. He chose not to live in Rome for a couple of reasons. First of all, he was scared to death of being assassinated. So this fortress that he lived in was built on an island at the top of a mountain on a coast. Pretty impenetrable, pretty safe. He was scared to death of being assassinated. And he also knew that his evil habits were so severe that even Rome, which we know was not a godly place, even Rome, even the Roman citizens, the Senate, all the people, the leaders in Rome, they wouldn't stand for some of the things he was doing. They thought even his actions were over the line. And so he moved out to this place. He could, in the distance, he could see Italy, the coast of Italy from there, and he ruled from over there. One of the reasons he ruled from over there was he had hired this position had never been in existence in the Roman government until him, a person he called the Master of Imperial Pleasures, which doesn't sound too bad on the surface, but what this man's job was he would comb the countryside, particularly places that Rome had conquered and that were not Roman citizens, although Roman citizens were not immune to this. And this man would go in and kidnap children. That's what he did for a living. He would both boys and girls. And they were brought in and asked to perform for them, him and his buddies and the people that he would invite to his house. They would bring them in and have them perform both with and for the various guests. And they were told that if their performance was good enough, they would live. And if it was not good enough, that they would be cast off of something that was called Tiberius's Leap, which was a cliff just on the outside of the palace that he lived in, the fort. And they would just throw him over the side, down to die on the rocks and on the water. So the children would perform thinking they were going to live. The problem was Tiberius couldn't let get out any of the things that were going on in the palace, so they all died in the end anyway. This is the man that's in charge of the Roman Empire. And I think it's important for us to understand that. Closer to home, as far as Christ goes, was, and I should say this too, Tiberius really doesn't directly interact with Christ, but who he is and how he rules definitely affects some of the things that go on, especially in this last week we're going to talk about. Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas, from what I could find, was about 50 years old or so, give or take, at the time of this last week in Jesus' life. He was the fifth son of Herod the Great. If you remember, Herod the Great was the one that tried to hunt down Christ as a baby. So, Herod Antipas is now in control. He was granted control of Galilee by Caesar Augustus, after the death of his father. Now, Herod is an interesting man because he was actually born in Judah. He is a Jew. He is a Jew by birth, but he was educated in Rome. And so if you were to walk up sometime and be able to meet him when he was alive, he would have looked like, acted like, talked like a Roman. You wouldn't have really been able to tell that he was a Jew. He kind of tried to hide that a little bit. He dressed and acted like Roman aristocracy, and he loved luxury, just like most of the Roman leaders did. the more luxury he needed, the more taxes needed to be waged. So he often raised taxes. He was an inexperienced leader, but he had always expected, being the son of Herod the Great, he always expected that he would be given a kingdom of some kind. So he felt privileged. Because of that, he brings Roman justice. He lives in fear of Rome rejecting him because he's a Jew and the things that he's doing, so he tries to be as much Roman as he can. So because of that, he brings Roman justice and heavy taxes to Judea, and all in the auspices of pleasing Rome. He does develop the habit of executing anybody that opposes him. We can see that in John the Baptist, right? He just seems to be, if you go back and read that account, he doesn't seem concerned with the beheading part. He only seems concerned with the after effects of what it might result, right? The beheading part wasn't a big deal to him. He did that often. He knows that he cannot be critical of Tiberius. He knows that. The Jews are growing angry with the Roman rule, and he's trying to hold this in balance. But his fear of Tiberius keeps him from doing anything, implementing any reforms, or doing anything that a good ruler would do to help his people out. So he's caught in the middle between trying to help the people and trying to please Rome, the man that appointed him, or the son of the man that appointed him. And so he tends to keep his mouth shut and accumulate as much wealth as possible. That seems to be his goal. We also have Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was a Roman citizen. He was all Roman. He was recommended for the job that he currently has. Oh, I didn't put that up there. Recommended for the job by Sejanus. Now, Sejanus was Tiberius's number one guy. But Sejanus was also a Jew hater. He had no problem walking in and killing Jews anytime he had a chance. He was a very violent man. And in the end, in fact, before this happens, for this week that we're going to discuss, Sejanus is actually killed by Tiberius. So Tiberius kills off his number one man because he's afraid that he's going to take over. And so this happens about AD 31, if I could find an average date right. He also kills off any of the people that supported or were associates of Sejanus. So, Pilate is one of those. But Pilate somehow is able to maintain his position. But he knows that he's on shaky ground with Tiberius because of his association with Sejanus. He is prone to arrogance. He feels like he should be the leader of some grand, important part of the Roman Empire. And he's stuck here in Judah, a position nobody wants, and a position that is considered beneath him. His wife doesn't like it here. She thinks he should be someplace else. But she understands that the potential of this place and time and this position being able to move him up in the world, be able to advance him. He is hated by the Jews from the get-go. The reason he's hated of the Jews is because his first official act desecrates Jerusalem. He gets put in power, and the very first thing he does is he decorates the city of Jerusalem, and even right outside the temple, with pillars and bust heads of Tiberius, of the Roman emperor. He just, here's a graven image, here's an idolater being lauded and praised in the city of Jerusalem. And it causes a revolt. The Jews protest this. They begin trying to tear these things down. They protest it. And the Roman soldiers, his soldiers, get them, these Jews, this group of Jews, surrounded. And he gives the order to draw their swords and kill them. He expects the Jews to disperse. But what the Jews did was they knelt down on the ground and stuck their necks out and said, "Go ahead. See what'll happen next." and he has to back down. And it's at that point that Tiberius kind of gains an understanding about how this is going to go. And so because of that, he sees the Jewish resolve, he backs down, and the soldiers are removed and the standards are removed. All the images of Tiberius are taken out of the city. And because of this standoff, he develops a new strategy. He forms a bond with Caiaphas, the high priest. And he thinks that through this bond, he can repair the relations with the Jews enough that he can maintain control. Now just kind of as an after effect, it's approximately 3 years after the death of Christ that Pilate puts down another rebellion of the Jews, and he kills unarmed Jews. And the Jewish leaders complain to Rome, and Pilate is recalled to Rome and never heard from again. So this man's going to die. Remember his wife said, "You need to leave this alone?" She was right. She was right. He's recalled to Rome, and it's not clear whether he was assassinated, was killed, executed, or whether he was asked to commit suicide, which was often what happened. But either way, he's never heard from again. Caiaphas. Now, if you remember what we just read in Luke chapter 3, it talks about Annas and Caiaphas being the high priests. And if you remember the trials and what happens, he does end up appearing before Annas. And they do call him the high priest. And we're going to talk about that when we get there. But Caiaphas is the legitimate high priest. But because Annas has been high priest recently, they kind of they're father-in-law. How many of you, if you were in a position of authority that your father-in-law just held shortly before, would not kind of lean on him and consider him and take his advice? Well, we probably would. If nothing else, just to keep family peace, you know. But so they kind of are co-priests in a way, but Caiaphas is the name. He's the actual high priest. He is the high priest. We talked about that. He lives very lavishly in the wealthy upper city. He does not live like a high priest is supposed to live. He doesn't live where the high priest is supposed to live or how the high priest is supposed to live. He knows that as long as Rome is happy, he will stay in power. The reason his father-in-law is no longer the high priest is because Rome got upset with him and made him step down, forced his hand. But they allowed Caiaphas to take over because Caiaphas was not a direct son, was a son-in-law. So they saw it as less of a threat. Because of this, he often turns a blind eye to some of the things that Pilate does. If Pilate is accosting Jewish citizens, Caiaphas kind of doesn't say very much very often. When Pilate raises taxes, he doesn't say anything. When Pilate loots the temple funds, which he would do from time to time, Caiaphas doesn't say anything. That's partially to stay in power, and that's partially because of their relationship. Pilate loots the treasury of the temple, and he gives Caiaphas a cut. He gives Caiaphas a cut. So every year there is a growing connection, between Rome and the temple. This linkage gets stronger and stronger every year Caiaphas is in power, and every year he's in power, there is a wider disconnect between the priesthood and the believers, the Jewish people. That gap just keeps getting bigger and bigger. So Caiaphas and Pilate, between the two of them, they have a stranglehold over Judah, specifically Jerusalem, but pretty much all of Judah. Caiaphas takes care of this through religion. He stays out of Rome's business, and Rome lets him do whatever he wants religiously. Pilate, through Rome, as long as he can keep Tiberius happy, he gets to stay in power. And Caiaphas stays in power. And as long as Caiaphas stays in power, Tiberius has more access to the Jewish funds and power from that side. They share the Greek language and the belief that they are entitled to do anything they want to stay in power. That's what the two of them think. Tiberius actually ends up giving instructions to Pilate on how to deal with the Jews, because he was so unsuccessful right at the first that Tiberius kind of lays down the law. Tiberius ended up, you remember, he's a real mess morally, but when he sees what the Jews do, sticking out their necks and saying, "We'll die for what we believe to be right," he kind of gains an admiration for them. He doesn't agree with them morally, but he gains an admiration for their devoutness to their beliefs. So he gives an order to Tiberius, change nothing already sanctioned by custom, but to regard as sacred trust both the Jews themselves and their laws, which are conducive to public order. Leave the Jews alone, is what Tiberius says. If their traditions, if their rituals, if the things they're doing religiously don't cause a problem, then leave them alone. And he's specifically told not to meddle in the matters of Jewish law. Don't touch it. This is an edict from Tiberius, who holds Pilate's life in his hands. So you can already see the foreshadowing of why Pilate is a little reluctant to get involved. He ends up doing it anyway. Let's talk just a little bit about Pilate and Herod. Pilate and Herod don't like each other. They don't like each other for a couple of reasons. The biggest reason is their overlapping rule. They kind of have different authority over the same territories, or at least side-by-side territories for sure, but their rule kind of overlaps a little bit. And Pilate sees Herod as a pompous, entitled, spoiled brat that did not earn his position. He's a Jew that won't act like a Jew, because Pilate didn't like the Jews. He's a Jew that won't act like a Jew, doesn't know his place, and doesn't deserve to be where he is. Herod sees Pilate as one of the ultimate symbols of Roman rule and authority in the area, and Herod kind of despises the low position that Pilate has in the Roman government. Pilate is a wannabe big shot, and Herod sees him as a nobody. So there's a lot of conflict there. However, they both loathe Tiberius. They hate him. They don't like what he does. They don't like how he rules. They don't like anything about him. But they know they have to keep him happy. So they keep giving positive reports about the city, keep sending him tax money, doing everything they can to keep him happy. Both understand, I guess I'm ahead of myself, both understand the danger that Jesus can pose. They both see that and recognize it. And they understand the potential penalties if this situation with Jesus is not handled correctly and effectively. When they become friends, remember, after Herod dismisses Jesus, it says that the two were friends from that day forward. Most likely they became friends because in that situation, Herod had a choice. He could be a Jew, or he could be a Roman. And he chose to be a Roman. And so Pilate begins to see him as more of an ally. All right. Let's set the stage just a little bit. Sometime prior to Sunday, the beginning of the week, sometime prior to Sunday, Pontius Pilate has returned to Jerusalem and moved into Herod's great palace temporarily. He doesn't live in Jerusalem all the time, but this is a huge time period this week that there's going to be a feast, there's going to be Passover, there's going to be lots of travelers coming to Jerusalem, lots of pilgrims, and he wants to be present to keep a handle on things and to watch what's going on. Also, all these people that are traveling to Jerusalem and going to be there for the sacrifices and everything, they are going to be paying tithes. While that money is sitting there, he wants to get his hands on as much as he can. And if he's not there, he might get left out. So he wants to be there. Herod Antipas arrives and stays just a few blocks away in the Hasmonean palace. Herod wants to be seen as a devout Jew to the Jews. He's not. He could care less about Passover or anything else that's going on. But if he's there, it'll help maybe his standing in the eyes of the Jews as a good Jew, even though he's not really. And everybody knows it. It's not a secret that he's not that interested in being a Jew anymore. Caiaphas, the high priest, is beginning his preparations for the Passover at his palace in the upper city. For Caiaphas, even though he's the high priest, this is not just a time of religious reflection and observation for him. This is also a time to show his authority over the people and to gain wealth as he dips into the coffers of the temple. All three have one thing that they're doing all the same. They're all watching for Jesus. They all have reasons to keep an eye on him. They all have reasons to be wary of him and his followers. And they all want to see if he's going to show up. Pilate and Herod are concerned about how Tiberius is going to view this potential troublemaker. And they've got to be there to see what's going on. And they understand how delicate the balance is going to be between controlling him, Jesus, and controlling the people. They understand how delicate this is going to be. And Caiaphas wants to catch him doing something bad enough that can convince Rome to put him to death and end this. So they all have this, all these different political agendas going on. We all got the background? Going too fast? I was afraid I was going too slow. Okay, so we have all these things happening, these people that are involved, all this intrigue, all these different storylines, all these backgrounds, and they are all going to meet right here in Jerusalem. And it's going to be a big result. It's going to be a huge event in the world. All right. Sunday. Now you can look at your timeline. Matthew chapter 21. Starting with verse 1. Now when they drew near Jerusalem and came to Bethphage at the Mount of Olives, and then Jesus sent two disciples, saying, "Go into the village opposite you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Loose them and bring them to me. And if anyone says anything to you, you will say, 'The Lord has need of them,' and immediately they will send them." All of this was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, "Tell the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you, lowly and sitting on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey." So the disciples went and did as Jesus commanded them. They brought the donkey and the colt, laid their clothes on them, and set him on them. And a very great multitude spread their clothes on the road. Others cut down branches from the trees and spread them on the road. Then the multitudes who went before and those who followed cried out, saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." And when he had come into Jerusalem, all the city was moved, saying, "Who is this?" So the multitude said, "This is Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth of Galilee." I want to jump over as well to John chapter 12. John's account of this starts in chapter 12 and verse 12. And I want to start... I'll just read how John puts it, starting with verse 12. "The next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they had heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him, and cried, 'Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel.' Then Jesus, when he had found a young donkey, sat on it, as it is written, 'Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt.' His disciples did not understand these things at first, but when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written about him and that they had done these things to him. Therefore the people who were with him, when he called Lazarus out of his tomb and raised him from the dead, bore witness. For this reason people also met him, because they heard that he had done this sign. The Pharisees therefore said among themselves, "You see that you are accomplishing nothing. Look, the world has gone after him." Okay. Who is paying attention to whether Jesus shows up or not? You've got potentially Tiberius, if he's aware of anything that's going on in Jerusalem, which I'm not 100% sure he is. You've got Pilate, you've got Herod, you've got Caiaphas, and all the other Jewish leaders, the Sanhedrin and all the Pharisees, everybody else that has any authority or power that doesn't like what he's saying. Jesus has on other times kind of snuck into Jerusalem, right? He's come in and they didn't really know he was there, or he would be there and for a while before they would realize he was around. But this is out there. There's no secret here. In fact, the prophecy there comes from Zechariah 9:9. It was one of the things that Jesus had to fulfill to be the Messiah, that he would come into the Jerusalem on a donkey. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about that account, the idea of coming in on donkey. They call him the king. Behold, your king is coming. Kings don't ride on donkeys. Kings ride on horses. They have nice saddles. They have entourages with armies and trumpets and everything else. But he comes in on the colt of a donkey. His disciples, there's no saddle, so his disciples put their coats on the donkey for him to sit on, to add some comfort. Then people are throwing their coats in the way and shouting out, "Hosanna," calling him a prophet. They are lauding the Messiah. And everybody in Jerusalem knows he's there. There's no hiding it. He's letting everybody know. Jesus knows that this is the end. That this is his triumphal entry. That's why we call it that. This is his chance to proclaim who he is by following the prophecy that people are going to know. This is his chance to proclaim who he is by them calling him the king, calling him a prophet, treating him like a king. How's Herod going to react to this? Herod's not going to like this at all. Herod thinks he's privileged. He thinks he's pompous. He believes that he has the right to rule. And so here he is. And here comes Jesus, seemingly almost taking that position. Pilate's not going to like it. If the Jews are proclaiming a new king that Tiberius has not set up, this is going to be seen as a revolt. Caiaphas doesn't like this. This is another proclamation of how powerful he's becoming with the people and how much authority that he appears to have. It's just amazing to me that in John chapter 12, we're told that his disciples didn't understand this at first, but later on, they completely understand it. But there has to be a little bit of understanding of what's happening, or the people wouldn't necessarily be reacting this way. And they're calling him a prophet. They're recognizing him as a prophet. The same one they recognize that called Lazarus out of the tomb. We know he has these powers. We know he has the power of God. And the Pharisees are sitting there saying, "We're not getting anywhere with this guy. We've got to do something more drastic. Because the things we've done before, challenging him, testing him, it's not getting us anywhere." At evening, they leave and go back to Bethany. That part is in Mark. We're going to be doing a lot of jumping around. If you haven't noticed, I have 4 bookmarks, so I can go back and forth pretty quick. But Mark chapter 11, verse 11, Jesus went into Jerusalem and into the temple. So he doesn't just walk into Jerusalem and do nothing. He does go to the temple. And when he looked around at all the things, the hour was already late. So he gets the lay of the land, he scopes things out, he makes his presence known. And then at the end of the day, they go back to Bethany because it was already late. And it says the 12 are with him. All his disciples are going with him. All right. Oh, I didn't click this at all. Well, there you go. I looked down and expected when I hit the button to see Monday, and it was still stuck on Sunday. All right, Monday. Jesus curses the fig tree. Let's look at Mark's account for this. I about said story. Mark 11, starting with verse 12. Now the next day, when they had come out from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing from afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. It was not the season for figs. There's things in this account that kind of help us understand the timing. This would indicate that it was sometime perhaps in the spring, but not quite time for there to be ripe figs on the trees. We also know that when was Passover? What month in their calendar? First month. So this is the beginning of their year. It's the beginning. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, that was a marking, part of the markings of the beginning of some of the harvest seasons and the marking of Passover. So we have, it's not the season for figs. All right, verse 13. I'm sorry, verse 14. In response, Jesus said to it, "Let no one eat fruit from you ever again." And his disciples heard it. And they move on. Now, this is why you're going to notice in the outline that there's some things that I'll say possibly. All right? So this fig tree event right here definitely happens, I think, on Monday coming back to Jerusalem from Bethany. It's not going to be concluded until later, probably. Not going to be continued until Tuesday morning. So he's now back in Jerusalem. They've made it all the way back to Jerusalem. And remember, he went, after his big grand entrance, he went to the temple. Looked around and then left. When he gets into Jerusalem this day, he goes back to the temple again. But he has a definite plan in mind. He's going to see he knows what's going on there, and he's going to take care of it. Matthew, chapter 21. Starting with verse 12. Then Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, "It is written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer,' but you have made it a den of thieves." Then the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. And when the chief priests and scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children crying out in the temple and saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they were indignant. And he said to him, "Do you hear what these are saying?" And Jesus said to them, "Yes. Have you never read, 'Out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants, you have perfected praise'?" He comes into the city, goes straight to the temple, and the first thing he does is a cleansing, we call it, of the temple. This is the second time he's done this. First time he made a whip, drove him out. This time he just grabs the tables and chucks them. Just like he made a huge statement about his kingship when he came into Jerusalem the day before, this time he makes a huge statement about his religious authority based on what's going on at the temple. He calls it my Father's house. They may not have realized he was literally saying my Father's house, because that was in the prophecy before. But he makes this humongous statement. What was going on at the time, if you were a Jew living somewhere else outside of Jerusalem, you had to use Roman money, Roman coinage, to buy and sell and do business. If you had a job, you got paid in Roman money. Everything was Roman money. The temple, because Roman money had the image of Caesar on it, it was used for pagan things, lots of different reasons, the temple would refuse to accept Roman money. So before you could pay your temple tax that you owed, you had to change your Roman money into the temple money. In the process of doing this, they had people sitting there at tables, just like if you were ever go into an international airport or somewhere else to exchange money, there's the window, and you just walk up, tell them how much you want to exchange, and unless you're really good with math and paying attention to modern current economic situations, you got to kind of take their word for it, don't you? You kind of give them their money, your money, and hope they're fair to you coming back. These people were not fair. There's a lot of reasons they weren't fair. The first reason they weren't fair was they made their money by charging you a little bit more. The second reason they weren't fair is that Caiaphas expected that part of your temple tax was having to exchange the money, and he got some of that. So now you're being overcharged twice. Caiaphas also knows he has to keep Pilate happy. So he's going to charge you a little bit more to keep Pilate happy. Then you've traveled a long distance and you need your sacrifice. So you take your temple money that you've been overcharged for and you take it over to the out to the animal traders and you buy your animal. And you spend a whole lot more for that animal than you would have at home. Because they're going to make some money. And they're going to give some money to Caiaphas, who's going to give some money to Pilate. I mean, you just can't win. You just absolutely cannot win. So what they were doing was they were coming in and taking the house of God. There was nothing wrong with the temple only accepting temple money and expecting you to exchange it for temple money. What was wrong was in the overcharging. What was wrong was the overcharging going to a pagan ruler and Rome. What was wrong was you having to pay too much for your animal so that money could go to pagan Rome. And so Jesus doesn't mess with teaching anything. Imagine you are in the throngs of people waiting to exchange your money, and you know this cheating is going on. What kind of a mood are you in? You're not very happy. If you remember back to Eli, the high priest Eli, and he was having trouble with his sons, right? One of the things that God tells Eli is the problem is that it's not just that his sons are not doing what they're supposed to do and are doing things they shouldn't be doing. What God tells Eli is, your sons are making it so that people don't want to come worship me. They abhor my worship because of your sons. That's the feeling you're going to have here. This is a duty, this is a ritual, this is something you have to do, but you don't want to do it. They've turned a time from... Wow, I am over. Okay. So he just throws the tables, and now you're not so sad anymore. Because that money's free. All you got to do is pick it up. And we'll pick up the story tomorrow.